From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, April 30th, the long last day of April.
Mm-hmm. Did you know it's Take Your Cell Phone to Work Day?
Is it?
Yeah.
Last week was Take Your Son or Daughter to Work Day.
Yeah.
Now, is your cell phone going to be as vocal as your daughter was?
That could be arranged.
Yeah. We've heard your cell phone on this podcast before.
Yes, but I blame the editor for that.
The audio editor would be me?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
The blamer is Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. The blamee.
Finger pointer in chief.
Yeah, the blamee is me, John Myers from KQED Public Radio. And so here we are, last day of April.
Mm-hmm.
April's over.
And we have a lieutenant governor.
Okay. You know that collectively 38 million Californians let out this big, exactly.
A big whoosh.
Yeah, that we have a lieutenant governor finally after all these months. Someone to get up in the morning, check to see if the governor has a pulse and goes back to bed.
Although Mona Pasquale, the acting lieutenant governor, did an admirable job.
I was going to say yeoman, and I think it's all nautical somewhere.
I hardly noticed John Garamendi was gone.
Well, maybe that's part of the problem with the job. But anyway, yes, Abel Maldonado, Republican from Santa Maria on the Central Coast, no longer a state senator, now the lieutenant governor of the state of California, the 47th lieutenant governor. I've got all my lieutenant governor factoids from the press releases from the governor's office.
How many could you name?
Abel Maldonado and John Garamendi and Gray Davis and
Merv Dimely
and Mike Kerb. Nobody can forget Mike Kerb. And then it gets a little fuzzy after that. There's some more somewhere.
Yeah.
We'll revisit our Lieutenant Governor podcast at a different time.
No Googling.
Although, the shortest serving, I did look up to see who the shortest serving was in modern history. And now I've forgotten his name sitting here on the fly. But he was the guy at the end of, I can't even remember that.
So Earl Warren's lieutenant governor?
No, I think he was the guy at the end. No, he's the guy at the end of the Reagan era. Yeah. But anyway.
Okay.
Someone will email in now and
say, the guy at the end of
John, why don't you have your facts before you sit down and do the podcast?
That is not an acceptable answer for Trivial Pursuit.
If they only knew how few facts we came in the studio with.
Oh, they know.
Oh, they know. They've heard too many. Okay, so let's talk about Maldonado. This will be the last lieutenant governor podcast for a while.
Okay.
Though I think there's possibility that the race for lieutenant governor actually could be interesting this fall for a job that we normally don't pay a lot of attention to.
Yes.
But let's talk about what happened. So Maldonado got his final confirmation from the state Senate on Monday. He had crossed the Rubicon of the assembly last week, and we thought all was hunky-dory. Everybody was happy. It was a great moment of bipartisanship, post-partisanship. And then all of that collapsed when we found out that the governor was not calling the special elections for Maldonado's Senate seat on the dates that the Democrats thought, and now we had a big kerfuffle. So talk about the kerfuffle. You covered that a lot.
I was on the kerfuffle beat.
You were.
For the last 3 months. Now, the Democrats wanted the election to be consolidated with the November general election.
That would be the primary or, I mean, not
no,
not
the,
primary,
runoff.
The general or the runoff,
the runoff
for a special election.
Right. And
because there are going to be two elections.
And they'll tell you it was so that more voters could participate and, fewer would be disenfranchised and it would save the counties money. The real reason is that more people would be voting and therefore more Democrats and give the Democrats a better chance to pick up the seat. I mean, look, well, we can pause there if we need to. Or we can move on. Anyway, the Democrats thought that they were oh so clever, particularly the Speaker, John Perez, by waiting until April 22nd to confirm Maldonado. That was the day that allowed the governor to consolidate the election, and the governor decided not to.
But let's just backing up, just because I think people have heard the shorthand a lot of this fracas. But you laid out part of it, which is this calculation about who can pick up the Senate seat, who, you know, the Democrats thinking they can pick up this in what they think is a competitive district. The registration numbers look pretty good. It's been held by a Republican, but there are a lot of Democratic stronghold areas in that district. So it's debatable.
20% decline to state.
Yeah. It's a competitive seat.
Yes. One of the few.
On paper, yes. And we'll see how it plays out. So that part is easy to understand. What's a little complicated, I think, is election law that I'm not going to get all into here. But as I understand it, the governor had a number of days in which he could issue the special proclamation right. for the special election. And he didn't have to necessarily issue the proclamation the day Maldonado became lieutenant governor.
Correct.
He could have waited a few days, which would have pushed the election calendar onward. And there was this theory that the Democrats thought the governor would go along with it. Although, interestingly, in your own article, Anthony York,
yes.
in Capital Weekly, which I referenced, I like to give you credit when I write and reference you with a hyperlink in a blog posting.
Well,
the speaker told you, you know, there's no guarantee the governor's going to go along. Now, at the time, that quote might have been read like, you know, he's just trying to kind of make it not like we've got a deal here.
Right.
But, in fact, it actually turned out to be true.
It was true.
Yeah. The governor didn't go along. The governor and now
then
has...
But then he got angry.
Yeah. But so the governor has now set two special elections.
Right.
There's a primary election.
June 22nd.
June 22nd. And then if no one wins outright, mm-hmm. which they won't.
Probably not.
I mean, in almost every one of these, no one wins outright. I mean, I'm just saying.
Well, we can talk about that a little bit more later.
Well, we can. But there are pretty good odds that you'll move to a next election in
right.
August.
The top vote getter in each party
yep.
then would move on to an August 12th runoff.
Right, exactly. In which case, then, theoretically, someone could become a new sitting senator on August 13th at the latest.
Mm-hmm. They have to certify the election.
Sometime
before we get a budget.
Maybe sometime before Labor Day. Well, and that was part of the governor's argument. The governor's argument was, I need somebody to be sitting in the Senate because, you know, we might have a budget vote.
And
if you wait until November, then someone's not going to be sitting in the Senate early enough. And you're not so sure about that argument.
Because the front runner for the seat is Sam Blakesley, an assemblyman from San Luis Obispo. And so if Blakesley becomes the new senator, then...
You're one short in the assembly.
Right. So
you're not going to have a full contingent there unless right. John Laird wins the race on the Democratic
Correct.
Side. But so all of this, you don't really need to know if you don't really care about Central Coast politics that much about that. The macro story, which is what you wrote, and I think is the thing that we have to watch as we go along, is what does this say about the back and forth relationship between the governor and legislative Democratic leaders? Because you can't love a soundbite or a quote better than the Senate pro tem, Daryl Steinberg, calling the governor a bonehead.
I think he said it was a bonehead move.
Oh, sorry. But if it's a bonehead move, isn't by definition being done by a bonehead?
Well,
no.
It could be bonehead-esque.
Okay.
I don't know.
And the governor likes to call people foreheads when they're not very smart. So yes. Is that – anyway. But so Steinberg made it quite clear. He was unhappy with it, called the governor – then said the governor's a lame duck. Then it was a great – what else?
We had 2 days of great press conferences.
Right.
And then he blamed the governor for using the Citizens Compensation Board to threaten lawmakers with pay cuts just to – so the governor could use that as leverage in budget negotiations. It was a fun week.
Well, I think what it did is it revealed a couple of things. It revealed the internal deal-making process that happens at the Capitol. Because the whole thing about the Citizens Compensation Commission, we were hearing last week, too, that was part of what some Democrats wanted in exchange to giving Maldonado the job, is they didn't want another pay cut.
Right.
And while, you know, no one has ever said that's the case, I mean, certainly these are all gubernatorial appointees. I know the governor's office says they're independent. I take them at their word. Yeah. But Steinberg started to draw a line back, you know, some, and who knows?
Well, and I confess, look, I when I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I mean, I thought the governor was in on this whole thing. I thought this whole thing when the governor withdrew Maldonado's appointment and then reappointed him.
I
thought there was a deal.
Grand plan.
I thought the governor was in on it. And, well, apparently not. Mea yep. culpa. Huh.
And so, and now you had this dust up, and the governor tried to dismiss the dust up. Mm-hmm. You know, in the press conference with Maldonado, he said, oh, you guys love it when it's, what do you say, when it sells tickets?
Yeah, he said, when we fight, it sells tickets.
Yeah, and I'm thinking...
Get your ticket to the newspaper.
That would
quick.
Movies or radio. You know, the governor tried to kind of walk back from that kind of back and forth a little bit. But the reality is, yeah, I mean, we've got people who don't necessarily have a great working relationship right now.
And I think that this is particularly true the dynamic between the governor and the speaker. John Perez has just been speaker since March 1st. He hasn't been a participant. This is his first go-around in budget talks. He was under some pressure, I believe, to prove to his caucus that he could wield some power and throw his weight around. And this became sort of a standoff between him and the governor. It was apparently not a negotiated settlement, but it was a game of chicken. And I think the governor, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but the governor called the speaker's bluff, right, on the delay, which is essentially what happened. And so it sets a tone going forward where you have the state heading into a budget situation where it looks like our revenues are going to be lower than projected. So we have at least a $20 billion hole. And you've got a governor and a speaker who don't seem to trust each other very much. And you've also got some other new blood. You've got a new Republican leader in the assembly as well, Martin Garrick. And so, you know, in Capital Weekly this week, we tried to look and tried to sort of read some tea leaves to see what the atmospherics are, right, going into budget negotiations. And you don't have to love each other to come to a deal, but and that's a good thing, because apparently the legislative leaders and the governor do not love each other, and they're not all on the same page.
And you know, and as another example of that back and forth this week too, we saw the governor's choice for the State Board of Education, Jeannie Oropeza, be rejected by the Senate, pretty much out of hand, and the Senate's reason, which I'm not disputing that this is the actual reason, an actual reason, but the reason from the pro tem, from Daryl Steinberg, was that she works for the Department of Finance as their top education advisor, their top education budget person,
Analyst, and that
you can't wear two hats advising the governor on education budget issues and sitting on the State Board of Education.
Could you wear a double-billed hat like Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you thought of that. That's perfect. If she was only wearing that.
Could have saved her.
But at the same time, too, that's a bit of that back and forth about an administration on the way out the door and a legislative leadership insistent that, you know, we're not just going to roll over and do what you want us to do.
I think part of the issue, too, was that that the way this announcement was made, that the governor had decided not to consolidate the election, it was made through the governor's press secretary at a media briefing. And apparently the night before, the governor had promised to call Steinberg and give him a heads up on his decision. And the governor apologized for that at the swearing-in ceremony of Lieutenant Governor Maldonado. And so, you know, it's it was a rough week in the Capitol. I mean, it was one that was, you know, there was a little action. There hasn't been any of that for a little while.
Yeah.
And so it was but, you know, whether there are lasting side effects or consequences from this week, I think remains to be seen.
And so let's talk about the one person who didn't have any of that, which was Abel Maldonado, just really quickly. So he gets the job he wanted, his lieutenant governor. My phraseology on this week was, I mean, here's a guy who you got to say played his hand of cards better than anybody in recent memory in politics.
Yeah.
And these were cards that he was dealt. These are not cards that he walked in with. I mean, I you know, part of it, he played it well, and part of it, he was just dealt a whole bunch of aces.
Yeah.
But, you know, trying to keep my poker gambling metaphor going.
Okay.
But, you know, look back to the February 2009 budget debate. Maldonado got everything he wanted for his budget vote.
Mm-hmm.
Parlayed that into a getting in good graces and making, you know, with the governor.
Right.
Parlaying that into Garamendi winning a special election to run to go to Congress, parlaying that into Arnold picking Maldonado, and then finally parlayed it into getting the job he wanted. He's always wanted a statewide position. This gives him one. He's the incumbent going into an election year as lieutenant governor. He's the only Republican Latino in 150 years in California in statewide office. He is the only moderate Republican Latino face out there in a Republican Party that needs to reach beyond its conservative base if they want to win in November, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they just lay it all right out in front of him.
Yep.
Yeah. That's
my expert analysis.
You won't disagree with any of that.
Well, I don't think he had anything to do with Ellen Tauscher being appointed.
No. No, but that goes back to being dealt
a little
whole
dumb
lot of good
luck.
Cards.
Yeah. A little dumb luck always helps.
Every now and then, you know, you have nothing to do with the fact that you get a handful of aces, right?
Yeah.
If you play poker.
Yeah, exactly. But if you get more than four, you know there's trouble.
But that's not to say, yes, you do, but that's not to say that he gets that hand for sure from here on out.
No.
I mean, he's got, I would argue he still has a very complicated path toward holding on to that job beyond 2010 because he has to clear the primary, which seems like a no-brainer on paper, given the fact that he's running against a person with real no-name ID and no money, Sam Onestad, a state senator from Northern California.
And by the time you hear this, Abel Maldonado will be a national media figure.
Yeah, he's on the Colbert Report on Thursday night. We're taping this on Thursday afternoon. But some people say Onestad is a favorite of the conservative base, and the Republican Party hasn't really liked Abel Maldonado of late. So they're saying don't discount that race. But if I did, then he moves on to a general election where, again, the registration numbers are favored to Democrats. He could be facing Gavin Newsom or Janice Hahn, and that could be a very tough race for him. So he may not have the job beyond 2010. So it's not a done deal that he becomes lieutenant governor for a while.
No, but he's also going to be the face of this of the open primary campaign, which
Prop 14
on the June ballot, which. Was placed on the ballot only after essentially Maldonado brought budget negotiations to a halt and demanded that this be placed on the ballot.
One of the demands I mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah. So,
what do you make though of the Maldonado connection to the gubernatorial race? Because I want to talk about this just for a minute. I mean, I think there are actually some things to think about here. I asked him after the confirmation vote. I couldn't remember had he endorsed someone in the race, and I would assume it was not Poizner, given he's been taking great issue with Poizner's stance on illegal immigration proposals. Mm-hmm. And he said he had not. He said he'd not been asked for one. And then of course he continues to talk about that he thinks the governor and lieutenant governor should run as a ticket someday. All of this gets to a Whitman Maldonado. Possible melding in my head because these are two people who could benefit from each other.
Sure.
Maldonado could benefit from jumping on the Whitman train, and maybe Whitman's got a little financial help somewhere to steer his way, for a campaign, or maybe he doesn't need that. And Maldonado gives Whitman credibility if she survives the primary, which it looks like she's going to, with this moderate Republican Latino brand. And I have to be careful here. Some people think that Maldonado gets this pass as a moderate Republican too often. I'm not here to judge whether or not he's a moderate. We go issue by issue.
He did vote for tax increases.
But that becomes the brand he has gotten out in the public. So I'm just trying to analyze it from that. Podcast emailers, don't harass me. But the point is, that gives her something too in the general election, with a Maldonado. And again, who would have ever thought if those two make it to the November election, that you'd be talking about a Republican Party with a Latino and a woman at the top of the ticket, and possibly a Democratic Party with two white men, Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom, should he make that primary win.
Right. In terms of the state races, of course, the Democrats will have Barbara Boxer running for
sure. But just looking at the situation there as it is, I think there's an interesting role about Maldonado in the governor's race.
Yeah, and we saw this in 1998 when Cruz Bustamante received the lieutenant governor's nomination for the Democrats. This was 1998, the first governor's election after Prop 187, the big Latino backlash against Republicans in California. This was the first post-Wilson gubernatorial race. And Gray Davis and Cruz Bustamante, who ended up feuding later on, but they basically ran as a ticket. Davis embraced Bustamante, took him on campaign events, and it was mutually beneficial for, mutually beneficial for both of them. I really almost said that. I really almost did.
It's all right.
So it's not without precedent, and I think that's exactly what we would see if Whitman and Maldonado are indeed their party's nominees.
So you're saying Schwarzenegger and McClintock in 2006 were not a ticket?
I don't remember. Were they in 2003 during the recall?
No. And they weren't in 2006. Not really.
No, not so much.
No, and certainly not now, because Tom McClintock, every other thing out of his mouth these days in support of Steve Poizner is,
Arnold Schwarzenegger's third term.
Third term is more appropriate.
Yes.
Anyway, so I think there could be a dynamic out of that. I think that's worth watching.
Okay, I'll watch it. Thanks.
And that's assuming Maldonado survives the Colbert Report,
which
I hope he gets that it's satire, but... You think he will?
Yeah.
The problem is that politicians...
I'm not saying I think he'll do well, but I think he gets
I was going to say, the problem is politicians continue to go on that show thinking they can beat the game. You can't beat the game. Colbert always wins those.
It's like he's like the Goldman Sachs of late night television.
Oh, transition, Anthony, you're
look at that.
All right, let's talk about Goldman Sachs because continues to be this issue it was a big week nationally about Goldman Sachs stuff with the executives being in front of Congress. And we all are trying to figure out what part it plays in the race for governor in California, because you have a candidate in Meg Whitman, who was a member of the board of directors of Goldman Sachs, who is an investor with Goldman Sachs, still has her money invested with Goldman Sachs.
Big time, to quote Dick Cheney.
That's not all Dick Cheney said, but no. That's a different thing.
Yeah. Well, it's what he was affirming. Anyway, moving on.
Right. See, once again, if you don't know that joke, then you probably shouldn't.
Google Adam Clymer, Dick Cheney, you'll figure it out.
Big time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Whitman does have these ties to Goldman Sachs. She was involved in this congressional criticism back in 2002 of people who had gotten IPOs from Goldman Sachs, with some sense that did an investor like Whitman get the IPOs in exchange for Goldman Sachs getting the eBay business when she was their CEO? The whole issue of this thing called spinning, which is kind of what I'm somewhat referring to here. Whitman says none of that stuff was improper. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It was just $1.8 million,
that's
John.
It.
It's, come on. It's like the quarters you find on your couch.
It's chump change.
Yeah.
Does this story have legs?
Yes.
In the governor's race?
Yes.
Okay.
It does, only because Goldman is becoming the big meanie of the housing crisis, right? And this is now... For Democrats, I mean, I don't know if it has legs all the way through November, but for Democrats, this has been their first opportunity to sort of they've been trying to link Whitman. They've been trying to sort of pry her loose from eBay somewhat and link her to Wall Street. And they've been sort of planning this attack on Whitman's record as a creature of Wall Street and all the CEOs who ripped you off and threw your economy into the trash can last year.
She represents all of them.
Yeah, and it seemed to be sort of falling flat. And this Goldman story, the fact that Goldman has become a national story and that Whitman has such ties to Goldman, even though Whitman was long gone by the time any of these derivatives that betting against the housing market were created, and even though it gives Democrats an opportunity to try to sell that narrative. And I think that in that sense, if and when there's a new poll coming out soon, I don't know, but we've seen in some polling already, not only with Steve Poizner now on the air hitting Whitman from the right, and this Goldman issue, and sort of, Meg Whitman is still largely undefined, remember, and the race in this election is going to be to define her, for Democrats to define her before she's able to define herself. And that's what this Goldman story allows Democrats to do.
And Whitman has she's addressed it only in little bits so far. She actually talked about it in her book basically gave it as a lesson of even when you haven't done anything wrong, you got to be careful that people don't perceive it the wrong way. That's the lesson out of the passage out of the book from what I've read. And then she gave an interview to the AP this week where she basically said the same thing, but then she also said something like, I didn't see the signposts, which, again, maybe that's I didn't see the signpost of perception. I don't know what that exactly means. But
was that a Timothy Leary reference? No? Doors of Perception? Anyway.
She also
said something in that interview with Juliette Williams, our podcaster.
Sometimes podcaster. We should have brought her in for this.
She said that she left Goldman because it wasn't a good fit, right? And you go back and you read the stories, some of them written by someone who now works for Meg Whitman. You read the stories at the time, and that wasn't what she was saying. She wasn't saying it wasn't a good fit. She was saying that she wanted to step down from the Goldman board so that eBay could continue to do business with Goldman without the perception of a conflict of interest. That's very different than saying it's not a good fit.
And she said it wasn't a good fit in the book, too.
Right.
But still, a change from the narrative of 2002-ish.
Right. And I think, there's another thing in watching this Whitman stuff. It's interesting to watch how the Whitman campaign takes a punch. Right. This is really the second time. The voting record was the first big issue, and she didn't really handle that one very well. And I think jury is still out on how she's handling this Goldman issue. But it tells you something deeper, I think, about the Whitman campaign and about her as a candidate. This is a big test. I think this is a pivotal moment for Whitman in the campaign, and we'll see how long Goldman stays in the news.
I just do wonder, though. I don't disagree with you there, but I spoke on a panel here on Thursday before a group of business people who were here in Sacramento, and mm-hmm. and maybe the people who made these comments have their own particular reasons they made it, but they wonder whether that's what the media is going to spend all its time on, or are we going to start talking about the issues that matter about who it is it's governor?
I'd like a third choice.
Well, no, and I know, right, yeah. Exactly. I'm not. Yeah, I don't see them as that clear a thing because right. I mean, I would argue that you know a person who's running on their business record and their integrity in the business world can't separate out these things
right.
completely out of that. But it does get back to this question about, you know, how much of this is relevant and how much of this is us when we start to smell blood, how the campaign reacts, and it's the horse race kind of part of it.
It is the horse race part, but I think that that goes a long way in sort of setting the tone for the race. And remember, I mean, all of this is before the Whitman campaign has unloaded their dossier of op research that they have on Jerry Brown. I mean, who knows what they have on Jerry Brown, all the things that he's said in 40 years in public life. And he had a talk, you know, he had his own radio show, and the guy does like to talk. I mean, you know, the Whitman campaign, I'm sure, will do their best to define Jerry Brown as well. And so are we still going to be talking about Goldman Sachs in November? Probably not, but will it feed into the perception voters have of Meg Whitman? If Democrats are lucky and if Democrats do their job correctly, then it will.
And you here on a Thursday afternoon found out an interesting tidbit about this Goldman story that's, right.
It just
is the way politics works.
Right. They have a new PR consultant, one of the masters of disaster, Mark Fabiani, whose business partner is Chris Lehane.
Now, well, and both of them are Democrats.
Right, both Democrats. Now, the interesting thing, Fabiani and Lehane are business partners they're crisis communications, basically.
They worked with Clinton. They worked with Gore.
Right, they worked, and they came under some scrutiny back during the energy crisis. They worked for Edison International. And then as the legislature was contemplating a major bailout bill for Edison, Lehane went to go work for Gray Davis. So,
and Lehane now works.
He now does work with Level the Playing Field, which is a union-backed
anti-Whitman
group.
So one partner working for Goldman, which is taking the brunt along with Whitman.
Right.
And one partner working for the anti-Whitman group that's beating the Goldman story feverishly out in the press.
Right. So,
I just want to make sure people got the image.
High compartmentalization, I think. But such is the power of
is the way that politics works. I mean, that's the reality of politics.
I guess so.
People, you know.
Anyway. Yep. So it is.
I guess that's that on that. And maybe we'll have more to talk about next week after the debate.
We can only hope.
After the Sunday. Debate on Sunday.
Oh, yeah. So are you going to that debate?
I am going to that debate.
Yeah.
I encourage everyone to tune in to that debate.
Are you going
to
be wearing your zebra suit? And whistle?
No,
aren't
I'm
you the
moderator
referee?
Of the debate, if you didn't know that. So, but I will not be wearing my referee outfit.
Do you get to say, like, let's get ready to rumble or something like that?
I think I get to say, and now a question for Ms. Whitman. I get to ask the first question. Okay. I get to ask the first question.
What's it going to be? Can you give us a hint?
I don't know which candidate I'm asking at it, so it depends.
Okay.
But that debate is Sunday at 5 o'clock. I'll just give you the little plug here. It airs on the California Channel, statewide TV, Comcast, Time Warner, Cox, I think it's like the Comcast Home channel. I don't know what the heck that is. And on demand. And then we're airing it on KQED Public Radio, and it's airing on public radio stations around the state, all at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. It's an hour before you have too many cocktails on a Sunday.
No, I'll be live blogging it at Politico.
Oh, will you?
At the LA Times political blog.
Oh, good.
latimes.com/CaliforniaPolitics.
But you won't have time to read that and watch us on TV. No, yes, you will.
Yes, I will.
Okay. No, not you. Yes, I mean, you, the listener. Not wrong you, Anthony.
Well, I'll be there after you've disappeared into the pixelated ether.
Got it. Got it. So that'll be interesting, and we'll talk about that next week. And then
we'll
next week.
Will it
we'll
really
also
be interesting? Can you promise that?
No, not so much.
Okay.
No, actually, yeah, we'll try to mix it up a little bit. And then next week on the podcast, I'm sure we're going to have to talk about budget issues because the legislative leaders are going to D.C. next week to talk about federal help for the budget. We'll have a better sense of April tax revenues, which, no surprise, they ain't looking very good. And all your favorite budget news next week.
So the good news is no more lieutenant governor talk. Right. Bad news is more budget talk.
No more Moldo. We're all done with that guy for now. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQBD. We'll see you next time.